It's Tuesday, May 2nd, and the only way they'd make this purchase was with a $50 billion coupon. We start here. J.P. Morgan takes over First Republic Bank with federal help.
Does it perpetuate potentially bad decision-making at the bank level?
So how healthy is the economy as big banks get bigger? Farmers were promised a type of bailout years ago, so why hasn't it arrived?
They intend to not make sure that these black farmers be successful.
Continued delays are reshaping who's able to work the land. And it's not a good sign when your doctor's computer is friendlier than your doctor.
The chatbot cleaned house.
What the chatbots can tell us about the future of medicine. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. So over the weekend, the U.S. government had a problem. First Republic Bank was about to become the third American bank in recent months to go under, to say, whoops, all these people deposited money with us and now they're asking for it back, but we don't have the cash. Normally, that's the bank's problem, right? Customers' accounts are insured, so they shouldn't be affected. If the bank goes belly up, whatever, too bad for them. But the fact that this was the third bank in a row, the fact that this was a bank lots of Americans had heard of, and the fact that many account holders have more than the insured amount, this was the government's problem. If we let them fail, will banking customers around the country start sniffing a trend? Will they pull their money out? Will more banks falter if they do?
We've got a lot to do. And the most immediate thing we can do is ensure the continued reliance of our economy and the financial system.
So, the government said, we're going to take this bank over. The question was what they would do with it. Yesterday morning, we got news that the government has orchestrated a deal for First Republic to be taken over by J.P. Morgan Chase.
J.P. Morgan Chase buying embattled First Republic Bank, which was near collapse.
Deal reached just hours ago in time for the markets to open after a weekend-long scramble to find a buyer.
Regardless of your bank, this is about to color how we see the banking system for the near future. So let's get this sorted out with ABC's chief business and economics correspondent, Rebecca Jarvis. Rebecca, I hope I'm making sense here because I need you to tell me, what exactly was this deal, first of all?
Okay, so it was an emergency deal, Brad. You got that part. It basically was the government and federal regulators seizing the assets of First Republic and then saying to banks, send us your bids, send us your offers to purchase First Republic.
The fire sale's on.
Exactly. And the winning bidder in this case is J.P. Morgan Chase. And J.P. Morgan Chase will be purchasing all of First Republic. So every deposit that was a First Republic deposit on Friday is now a J.P. Morgan Chase today. And those 84 locations, there are branches in 8 different states of First Republic. They now become J.P. Morgan Chase branches. They'll see their signage change over. Not immediately. I actually drove past one of them today. It was still First Republic outside, but the controller is now Chase, and they will, in the future, have new logos on the front door that say J.P. Morgan.
I'm confused that, First Republic is a bank that owes people more money than it's got. It owes money. Why would anyone want to buy that thing?
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe no one did want to buy it. I mean, that's kind of the answer here. Mm-hmm. Nobody bought First Republic last week before the government stepped in. And that is kind of a key here that without any kind of concessions, without any kind of help or lubrication, so to speak, financing from the government, there was an interest from an outside party. But the reality here is that some of the First Republic clients could be very interesting to a bank like J.P. Morgan. First Republic is known for having ultra high net worth clients primarily. So suddenly J.P. Morgan has access to some of those names. Perhaps they're people who will do other kinds of business in addition to just having a deposit with them. Maybe they'll also
We could offer this guy a loan now that he's our customer.
A loan, a stock brokerage account. There are plenty of ways that you might make fees on those individuals. That said, you also raise an important point, which is they had a pretty giant hole to fill because as we learned last week, and this is really what precipitated the decline, at least in this most recent week of First Republic, we learned that dating back to the Silicon Valley bank crisis, over $100 billion worth of deposits fled First Republic. And that's why you got this sort of combo deal where the government takes over, finds a bidder, J.P. Morgan happens to be the best bidder in the eyes of the government, and that's who owns First Republic now.
First Republic. Is this it? Are you bracing for more banks to fail?
So let me lay out a couple of things, as we haven't really had an opportunity to speak to this.
So the government is chipping in. The FDIC is chipping in $50 billion in financing to get this transaction done.
Today's actions ensure the continued resilience of the banking system, including at community and other banks, which are vital to the American economy, small businesses, and workers as well.
The agency estimates that the ultimate cost to the FDIC will be about $13 billion. And keep in mind, the way that the FDIC gets that kind of money is that the banks pay into an insurance pool so that if a bank goes out of business, they're all paying some amount to cover the insured deposits.
That's what I was going to ask, Rebecca, is because when I hear the FDIC is chipping in billions of dollars, your mind immediately goes to, oh, so this is a bailout. Like the government's you're saying this is not taxpayer money that's going to First Republic?
It shouldn't be taxpayer money.
No taxpayer dollars will be used to facilitate this action. Any losses associated with the resolution of First Republic will be borne by fees on banks and not by taxpayers.
The FDIC is funded by the banks. So ultimately, what JP Morgan is getting here is money that it has paid, as well as other banks have paid, into this federal insurance fund, which is meant to do just what it's doing right now, which is to save depositors from losing all of their money when a bank goes under. And what I think some regulators, as well as some analysts, are concerned about is the moral hazard in a decision like this, because does it perpetuate potentially bad decision making at the bank level? Mm. Does it perpetuate greater risk taking because banks know they can offer whatever they offer to their customers, and that ultimately the government, if they're large enough and if they are enough of a systemic risk, will step in and find a way to create a deal with a bank like a JP Morgan, a big bank? The other issue that this raises is that it makes the biggest bank in the country bigger.
That was my other question. Is it a good thing that all of a sudden, like, JP Morgan Chase is buying these regional banks that we've always been told are so great for this country?
Well, the reality is, this is sort of what happened coming out of the financial crisis as well. Mm-hmm. Even though there were all of these banks that were too big to fail, and we really wanted to keep that systemic risk from creating bigger problems for our financial system, we're sort of back in the same place, which is to say, those too big to fail banks are only going to get bigger.
The process that has been put in place, the tools that have been put in place, has actually been working. This is not 2008. This is a very, very different time.
It is a concern for regulators to contemplate, which is that the big banks will continue to survive, whereas the small banks continue to be at a greater risk. That said, as of now, when analysts look at this picture, they kind of see this as closure to the banking crisis that started in March. First Republic was always a bank that was teetering on the brink. And it was a lot of the things that investors were concerned about might be happening at First Republic were validated in the earnings report. So when analysts look at this story, by and large, they see this as an issue that has been contained for now. That said, interest rates are climbing. There's another Fed meeting later this week. Interest rates are likely to go up at least one more time. And as interest rates go up, that makes banking more difficult for some banks.
Yeah, that kind of seems like the takeaway here, that analysts say this is the end of a cycle that was kind of brewing already instead of the beginning of something even larger. And worth remembering, by the way, if you have $250,000 deposited in a bank, that is insured wherever you're banking. Like, the government has to pay you that money back if your bank went under or something. Rebecca Jarvis, thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, imagine being promised the money that could rescue your family and it never shows. The money and the land are drying up after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
We talked about how important it is for Americans to feel secure in their finances, how that baseline financial stability can affect almost every part of your life, right? Your career, your ambitions. Well, in her series, Through the Cracks, ABC's Rachel Scott has been taking a look at what happens when people are told the government's got their back, offers to steady the ship. Where does that money go from there, though? And what happens if the money never arrives? Rachel's with us now. Rachel, I mean, you were looking at farmers here, specifically at black farmers, right? Well, what is the issue?
Yeah, exactly, Brad. So we really sort of dug into this trend that we've been seeing play out over the last 100 years, where black farmers are losing more and more land. We traveled down to this rural town of Keysville, Georgia, to meet Lucius Abrams. He's 70 years old. He's a third generation farmer.
On this particular land, we used to farm like soybeans, cotton, corn, wheat.
And typically, this is planting season. This is the time where he would start tending to his crops. But his farm is not operational. I mean, I could tell you he spends most of his time wandering around his 600 acres of land looking at things that he does not have the money to fix.
The motor's gone out in that one over here. And the truck in the back there, the motor's gone out in it too.
He is $1.2 million in debt. But over the last three decades, he has received countless letters from the federal government promising to wipe out his debt. The only problem is that money hasn't showed up, Brad.
Do you feel left behind?
I feel like that it's intentional.
So Lucius is actually one of thousands of black farmers across the country who were promised debt relief from the federal government and still haven't received anything. So this goes all the way back to 2021. Congress approved $4 billion in loan forgiveness for farmers of color. This was a program that was really designed to help address the historic discrimination by the USDA that they've actually acknowledged, where they've routinely denied loans to black farmers and other farmers of color. But this is a program that was really just stopped in its tracks. It never got off the ground. It was halted by this lawsuit from white farmers who claimed that they were being excluded because of their race, that they couldn't actually get this benefit.
Open as a class action lawsuit. We immediately got an injunction, and the federal government never appealed the injunction.
We talked to Sid Miller, who is the Texas Agriculture Commissioner.
I'm all for helping minority farmers, all farmers. But our U.S. Constitution forbids our government from discriminating against a citizen because of their race.
And so to avoid this long, drawn-out legal fight, Democrats quietly rewrote the plan, and they removed references to race and split up the relief into two different funds. So essentially, they made it more broad.
How did it make you feel?
Awful. I mean, you know, there's no way to describe it. That clearly shows you that they intend to not make sure that these black farmers be successful.
And those farmers that got those letters never got the relief that it was actually promised.
Well, why the delay, Rachel? What's going on?
So once the bill was rewritten and that law was passed, it essentially started everything over again.
When the lawsuits came and we were actually faced with an injunction, the Department of Agriculture, the Farm Service Agency, was prohibited from doing what those letters said we should do.
And so these farmers now have to qualify under this new program. You have the USDA that's trying to rush and get this money out to farmers in need.
We had figured out that we could make roughly $800 million in payments to about 13,000 borrowers, and we did that.
But those are the farmers with like the easiest cases, right? Where their information's already in the system. They can go and see that they owe this much debt. They're helping these distressed farmers that have already applied. There are a lot of other farmers that have a lot more complicated cases. For instance, there are some farmers where they now owe more in interest than the actual principal of the loan, where their names maybe don't match on certain loans or certain forms. We're talking about farmers that have owned this land for decades, right? So what we're finding essentially is some of the farmers that originally applied for this program don't know that they have to reapply. That's number one. And then secondly, they're also, you know, realizing that there's more complicated cases out there. So the USDA says they're really trying to take their time to make sure they're doing this in a way that's equitable and fair.
But right now we're focused on implementing it and getting people back farming and participating in programs as fully as they can.
At this point, Brad, they really aren't tracking who is getting this money by race. And when you have decades of discrimination that has happened within the USDA for Black farmers, there's a level of mistrust here. And so you have many Black farmers who worry that this money will never actually reach them.
They called me back in November of last year. And guess what? As of today, nothing.
We actually did our own analysis of USDA data, and we saw that Black farmers actually have the lowest approval rating for direct loans. These are typically the easiest type of loans to get. So of all the Black farmers who applied for direct loans in 2022, only 36% were approved. Compare that to all the white farmers who applied, 72% were approved.
What will that moment be like for you when you're back out here farming on this land?
Exciting, because I'd love to see things grow. I love to just see, smell the fresh dirt. It's a feeling that you can't describe.
One thing that's really interesting here, Brad, we went down, we traveled to Keysville, Georgia, then we came back and we talked to the USDA. And just days after giving the USDA Lucius's information, they cleared his $1.2 million in debt, Brad.
Oh, so now Lucius is fine, now that ABC News has asked the USDA what was going on.
Yeah, but there's still so many other Black farmers out there that we've talked to that are still waiting, and not everyone has had their story covered.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing, Rachel, is what effect does this have on the farming, like the entire farming industry, particularly in the South, particularly for Black Americans? Because I think of it as such a generational occupation, right? Like, you did it because your parents did it, your grandparents did it. So if people leave farms now, you'd think that that could continue to change the landscape well after they're gone.
Well, Brad, at this point, Black farmers are fearing extinction. I mean, over the last century, they have lost 12 million acres of land. This is land that was passed down to them from their grandparents, maybe their great-grandparents. This is all that they really know.
What does this mean to you?
It's a sense of pride to own land. This is something that could be wealth for the family.
And now something that has become a way of life is slowly being erased at this point.
The majority of the Black farmers that we've been talking with are people that have not gotten the resources that they deserve.
So you have two Black senators up on Capitol Hill, Senator Cory Booker and Senator Raphael Warnock. They have been leading this charge of trying to make sure that relief from the federal government reaches these farmers that are in need of it. But that process is slow.
There's so much to the business that you don't control. The margins of profit are thin, and it's easy, literally, to lose the farm.
And right now, they're calling on the USDA to get this money out as quickly as possible because, look, we're already in the middle of one planting season. If these farmers miss a next, they fear that they may not be able to survive at all.
Yeah, and throughout this series that you've had, Rachel, Through the Cracks, it's been a really powerful look, I think, at government institutions, you know, stepping forward, saying to people, especially during the pandemic, we are here to help you out during this time. And then for whatever reason, that kind of exposing some of the underlying tensions that have already even been there before. Rachel Scott, great work as always. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, it's more human than the humans. One last thing is next. And one last thing. When we think of robots, they're shiny, they're cold, they're emotionless. Think Terminator, or maybe the robot from that horror movie. Megan? What was it? Mithrigan?
Megan, turn off! Oh, I'm afraid that won't work anymore, Kate.
But as artificial intelligence chatbots improve, they might be coming across less like Terminator and more like Wall-E.
Wall-E.
Recently, a new study was published in the Journal for the American Medical Association in which researchers took medical questions that had been posted on social media, they had doctors answer them, then they asked OpenAI's tool ChatGPT to answer them, and they gave each response a score based solely on empathy, how much empathy is being conveyed right here. Have you dealt with chatbots much, Dr. Kaplan? I'm talking to you in real life right now, right?
Yes. It's really me.
Oh, shoo. Okay.
I have. As recently as the other day for a class, I punched in my name to see what it would do with my obituary.
That is Arthur Kaplan, who's definitely a real human.
I am the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine in New York City.
And as someone who studies doctor-patient interactions, he had his eyes on this study. So, who sounded more human? Humans or robots?
And the chatbot cleaned house, did much better according to all evaluations.
Did better than the human doctors?
Yes, much better.
He says while some human doctors came across as cold, cerebral, or rushed, ChatGPT has now scraped up enough human language to know how patients prefer to be talked to. For instance, you tell a doctor you got a migraine, a doctor could say, yeah, that happens all the time. Or, that sounds terrible. I've seen how debilitating migraines can be. We should take this really seriously. Both of those responses are correct, but medical schools say the second one is a lot better.
Does it matter if somebody's nice or empathetic? Does that have an effect on the actual treatment at all?
I'll tell you what I think it does. I think it makes patients more forthcoming and honest about their problems. So, literally, if I go in and say I've got a sexual difficulty, and the doctor isn't very responsive to that, I'm going to clam up and kind of say, well, you know, it's hard for me to talk about this anyway. Now I'm really not going to talk about it.
There are good reasons for the differences here. A lot of doctors are burned out. They're rushed between patients. Some say this could be the solution. Have a doctor do the doctoring while chatbots do intake. But some argue companies are going down a dangerous path as they increasingly create new products based off AI. Just yesterday, the so-called godfather of AI, Geoffrey Hinton, revealed he's quit his job at Google, where he worked for more than a decade, so he can freely speak out about the risks of artificial intelligence. One of his chief concerns is that these programs mimic human speech so well, they can sound even more convincing than most of us about stuff they're not even sure about. Kaplan says empathy is a valuable skill, but only if it's backed up by knowledge and nuance.
The other problem is chatbots, like all AI, they skim off the cream and they sort of take the best response. This sounds a little strange, but that isn't always what the patient needs. If they have something rare or weird or something's particularly odd, the chatbot tends to average. The doctor at least can empathize, look at a situation and say, boy, there's something unusual about you. I don't think we're going to go the standard path.
And that might be the real irony here. One of the chief complaints from patients is that doctors act like they're above it all, right? They know more than you, they have less time than you. That indifference can come through in their words. Artificial intelligence has all the words, but perhaps is even more indifferent to individual circumstances. Because when you're facing down a medical dilemma, you want someone to listen, not just to chat. The other interesting thing Kaplan brought up to me is this idea that we're talking about language being so empathetic, it's matching up with patients' needs. Whose language are we talking about? Some folks like keeping it matter of fact. Some people come from cultures where doctors talk more, talk less. But he also says you could actually train computers to adapt to different patients more easily than human doctors can adapt. So one more reason the revolution is happening. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia, Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.